He does it out of his kindness for the sake of his devotees. He reveals himself and he appears visibly to them. Now we're on 78.14. Atra. No? Yeah.
Yeah,
we rang the bell. I think everybody's here. Atra Sri Ramanuja Sharirake Hidarshitamidam. In this same regard, the following is presented in the Vedanta commentary of Sri Ramanuja. Ramanujacharya says in his Sri Bhashya. Most of these quotes in the Sri Bhashya, actually there are many more in the Sarasambhadani. Usually it's quoted from the very first sutra because I'm looking for the reference here. Down. Sri Bhashya 111. It usually is 111. Of course there's 400 and something sutras in the Vedanta. Sri Bhashya is a relatively long commentary. Well, it's longer than Govinda Bhashya and some other commentaries. Sometimes the Madhvites like to complain about that. Ramanujacharya writes too much. You know, Madhvacharya is more concise. And actually, one quarter of the whole Sri Bhashya is the comments on the first sutra. Ramanuja presents the whole Siddhanta in his comments to the first sutra. And then the comments on the other sutras are relatively shorter. So almost all the quotes that Jiva Goswami gives from Sri Bhashya is from Sri Bhashya 111. Like this quote. So shnute sarvan kaman sahabramana vipashtita iti brahma vedana palam avagamayad vakyam parasya vipashtito brahmano gunanantiyam praviti. Ramanuja. The words, he enjoys all desirable things belonging to the all-knowing Brahman. Now that's a different translation that we usually give. Sa Brahmana. The Pashyata can be understood as he enjoys all desirable things in the company of the Absolute Truth. But here, Ramanujacharya is giving a different slant on it. This is Taittiriya Upanishad, beginning of the second section. It's actually Satyam Gyanam Anantam Brahma. Iti Veda Guhayam Nihitam Guhayam Soshnute Sarvakama. The one who knows the Absolute Truth as Satyam Gyanam Anantam Brahma, he enjoys all desirable things. So Ramanuja's version of this is he enjoys all desirable things belonging to the all-knowing Brahman. Let's see. Explanation of that. Which tells of the benefits of knowing Brahman, thus describing the unlimitedness of the qualities of the supreme all-knowing Brahman. The point that Ramanuja draws out of it is that Brahman has unlimited qualities. Vipashita Brahmana Saha Sarvan Kaman Ashnute. He partakes of all desirable things belonging to Brahman. Okay, still haven't seen why he says that. Let's continue. Why doesn't he just say along with Brahman, in the company of Brahman? Even move the words around. Vipashtita Brahmanan Saha Sarvan Kama. Still could be understood as he enjoys these kamas in the company of Brahman. But he doesn't. He sees it this way. Let's see his explanation. Kam yante iti kama kalyana gunaha. Kamas means that which is desired. In other words, auspicious qualities. Those are kamas. So a kama here would be in karmani, kartari prayoga. Karmani prayoga. It's the thing that's desired. It's called a kama. Usually kama means the activity of desiring. means desire, lust. That's bhava vacha. But this is taking it as karmani vacha. What gets desired is called a kama. All auspicious qualities, that's what's desirable. Kalyana gunaha. Para brahmana saha. Tad gunan saravan ashnute ityartaha. Together with Brahman, he partakes of all the qualities of the Supreme Brahman which accompany him. Well, because he puts it in that order, brahmana saha tad gunan, those qualities which are with Brahman. Okay, because the point is, Brahman's got a lot of qualities, he's got infinite qualities. And one who knows Brahman can share all those qualities, or realize them, or relish them. Not that anybody can realize every single quality, but potentially you can realize any of the qualities if Krishna reveals. He partakes of all the qualities of the Supreme Brahman which accompany him. And then Ramanuja goes on. Dahara vidyayam tasmin yaraktas tarvishtavyam iti vad guna pradanyam vaktum saha shabda iti. Okay. As in the dahara vidya, the meditation on the most subtle, which is a vidya or a meditation that's taught in the looking for the footnote. Okay, where is that from? The Dhara Vidya is 30. I'm even number 30. I'm looking for Chandogya Upanishad, 8th chapter. There are 8 chapters in the Chandogya Upanishad. There are 11 Vedanta Upanishads, but most of them are short. A couple, like 1 or 2 pages, 3 pages, 5 pages. The Chandogya Upanishad, if you have it in the text, about this size, nothing but the text, it's about 30 pages. And the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, maybe 60 pages. So they're the two long ones, the Chandogya and the Brihadaranyaka. Chandogya is divided into 8 chapters. This is the beginning, very beginning of the 8th chapter. Tasmid yadantas tadavneshtavyam. It's the middle of the sentence, but it's the first sentence. The Dhara Vidya teaches about the subtle sky, or the lotus in the heart, and in that lotus there's a subtle sky, and you should meditate on what's in that subtle sky inside the lotus inside your heart. In other words, you should, and that's interpreted by Ramanuja to mean you should realize the qualities that the Supreme Lord possesses. As in the Dhara Vidya, the meditation on the most subtle, it is said, one should search for that which is within it. See, yadantas is used adjectivally. What is inside it? Not one should go inside it and look, but one should look for what is inside it. So here also, brahmana saha is not adverbial, not that one enjoys the kamas along with Brahman. That's one way to look at it. But the other way that's being presented here, you can enjoy or relish all the qualities that are with Brahman. Same kind of construction as tasmid yarantas tadam veshtavyam. So similarly here, the word saha, together with, is used to indicate a focus of attention on his qualities. In other words, brahmana saha modifies the qualities that are with Brahman. That's Ramanuja's, so he finally in the last sentence explains how it is he says it that way. You know, justifies the translation. He enjoys all desirable things belonging to the all-knowing Brahman. Okay, commentary. Acharya Ramanuja of the Sri Sampradaya also comments on the pleasure derived from personal association with the Supreme while discussing a passage of the Taittiriya Upanishad. Where else was it discussed? Sridhar Swami was talking about it, about how the four Kumaras experienced ecstasy. Now here's Ramanuja talking about the same thing, theoretically. How one can experience the ecstatic qualities of the Supreme. Could I get some water? Okay, Acharya Ramanuja of the Sri Sampradaya also comments on the pleasure derived from personal association with the Supreme while discussing a passage from the Taittiriya Upanishad. That Upanishad talks about the ecstasy of God realization and the fulfillment of all desires. Desire, and Mayavadis won't agree with that, but we understand the Taittiriya Upanishad talks about the ecstasy of God realization and the fulfillment of all desires. Desire is unavoidable and natural to the soul. Some things we can't avoid, but they're not natural. But desire, in general, is unavoidable and it's also natural. It's not something undesirable. Fulfillment of desires is wholesome when it is related to the Supreme Lord. I don't mean harass God about giving you material things you want, but a proper relationship. Pursuit of material desires is unhealthy. In fact, I'm going to change that. When it's related to the Supreme Lord's desires, or the Supreme Lord's pleasure. Not just related to the Supreme Lord, because you can go to God and demand your daily bread. That's not the same thing. So the Supreme Lord's pleasure. Pursuit of material desires is unhealthy because it is misdirected to wrong objects. We try to, so desire is not bad, but material desire is bad, unhealthy, because it's misdirected to wrong objects. We try to exploit for ourselves things that are meant to be used in the service of the Lord. And we exploit other persons as if they were also mere things meant for our selfish gratification. And one important point, one second. And one important point, the Taittiriya Upanishad 2.1 defines the Supreme Truth and the benefit of coming to know Him. Satyam Gyanam Anantam Brahma Yoveda Guhayam Parame Vyomni Soshnute Sarvakaman Sahabramana Vipashchita. The Mayavadis take this as one of the Mahavakyas, Satyam Gyanam Anantam Brahma, describing supposedly Nirguna Brahman, in terms of his gunas. It's contradictory to say that. How's this Nirguna Brahman? Here's the gunas, Jnana, Ananta, how are those not gunas? Anyway, this they take it as one of their four big statements from the Upanishads, Mahavakyas. But they have to take it out of context to not see it as a devotional statement. The Absolute Truth is real existence and consciousness, unlimited. One who knows that truth in the core of his heart and in the topmost sky enjoys, because the Supreme is in both places. He's in your heart and he's also in the topmost sky. Enjoys all the objects of desire which belong to that omniscient Supreme. I'm taking Ramanuja's reading on it. About Saha Brahmana Vipashchita. He enjoys all the objects of desire that belong to that omniscient Supreme. So that actually clarifies things. It's not like you go to heaven and you can, enjoy with the dancing girls and drink wine. But you enjoy the things that are directly connected to the pleasures of the Supreme. You enjoy with Him, not some selfish material enjoyment. So that's the value of Ramanujacharya's way of reading it. Or taking another interpretation of the word saha, then the one given by Ramanujacharya in his Sri Bhashya, the second sentence can read, one who knows that truth in the core of his heart and in the topmost sky, enjoys all objects of desire in the company of that omniscient supreme. Either way, the Supreme Lord and his personal qualities are the focus of real enjoyment, not the temporary things of this world. And we should be aware that the Supreme shares his qualities within limits. How's that? He's unlimited. But he restricts himself. No one can become exactly equal to God. He is the superior enjoyer. And the devotees enjoy with him in subordinate roles. He is always the supreme controller of his energies, even for his pastimes, he acts as inferior to his older friends, parents, and consorts. He acts as if he's inferior, but he never actually is. That's the restriction. He's always still God. He can't abdicate. He's God forever. The Dhara Vidya of the Chandogya Upanishad is a program for discovering the Supreme Lord in meditation. Within one's heart, there is a subtle sky, the spiritual realm. And in that sky, there is a city, the Supreme Lord's personal abode. One should search for what is in that city, which is the Lord himself. In other words, what is in the city refers to the Lord's qualities. Just as the Taittiriya Upanishad's words, Saha Brahmana, describe the objects of true desire as belonging to him. Okay, any questions?
I read that this is just a comment as a thought that I read that this point about attaining or enjoying things in relation to the qualities and in relation to Hari, relation to God, instead of like you said, they're going to heaven and enjoying, because even if people speak of jihad and they fight in the name of religion and God as God, but then the other than God, it has nothing to do with God. All of a sudden, God is out of the picture when they go to heaven and enjoy. There's no question of
God's not there?
I mean, serving, how do they serve God by enjoying big wine, etc., etc.? So it's
like you serve God, get it over with.
Yeah.
Don't do it. Don't continue doing that. It's like, you work for a while, then you retire from devotional service and enjoy on vacation or retirement. If you really don't want to enjoy, then don't serve Krishna. No, if that's really your attitude. So devotees are reluctant to take anything for themselves. When they're enjoying, they understand that Krishna is serving them. Krishna's arranging for their pleasure, so they really don't want that. They don't want to take service from Krishna. That's one reason they don't want it. It can be a distraction. Like, who was it? Dharva is fanning Krishna, and he's feeling ecstasy, but he's afraid that it'll affect the quality of his fanning, so he holds back the ecstasy. But they can't help it. That transcendental enjoyment is so attractive that they can't help but want it anyway, ultimately.
The servant, the king who is near, he gives palaces and he can enjoy all facilities, like, for example, I don't know if you share the sometimes people from travels in Canada and then they stay in some luxury apartment. Just the reason is that they don't go out, don't get this, they enjoy the same peace.
Yeah, or devotees living in a fancy temple, but they're there as the servants. They shouldn't be there to enjoy the facilities. They're there to do their service, to serve the proprietor, the master. But they get to enjoy the facilities that they, you know, can't avoid that. You can keep a simple, you know, take only the bare minimum. Don't take more than you need, but still you're enjoying the facilities. That's okay.
So it doesn't mean that whenever, for example, we have hot water and out of stage is hot, we just switch off hot water and just cold water.
Turn off the hot water? You can if you want to.
Not to avoid enjoyment in this facility. So it's not a problem. You should use it.
Well, if you can, you know, it is recommended we take a cold shower. So if you won't get sick and it won't be very painful, you could do that. You don't have to use hot water if you don't want to. But if you can't function, you can't stay healthy, then you better take the hot water.
So balance is to just take whatever you really need to focus.
What you need for your service, not what you need for to bear survival, you know, or to sacrifice yourself, you know, but what you need in order to keep on doing your service. And to do your service, you got to be peaceful. You got to be satisfied with yourself, with the world. You can't be disturbed and do nice service. But you get disturbed by having too little and also by having too much.
This Chandrila Upanishad's discussion about the subtle sky in the heart and searching the city, and is it a figurative or is it a real thing that
should... it's figurative in that it's not really a lotus flower, it's not really a city, you know, with skyscrapers and so on. It's the Vaikuntha being described as a city, and the heart is described poetically as a lotus. It's not literally a flower. You don't have a flower in your chest. But it's a real process. This is a real meditation that works if you do it. But it involves symbols, you know, poetic symbols. Yes?
Actually, in Chandogya Upanishad, there's a stronger verse in the Feet Maya about the end of the 12th chapter, 8th section.
Chandogya Upanishad.
Chandogya Upanishad, 8.12, 8.13, Atma Krida, Atma Rati. This destroys my God. But my question is concerning Ramanuja. I thought that he thought that Narayan is the Anshi of Krishna. And what did they think concerning Brahman? Is Narayan then the source of Brahman? How do they think?
Narayan is the Paratattva. So Brahman would be... I don't know. I don't know his description of Brahman. I don't remember reading that. I would presume it would be very similar to what we hear from our acharyas, from Jiva Goswami, that Brahman is an aspect. But I'm not sure. I'd have to look and see, because it's been a long time since I've directly read anything by Ramanujacharya. Years ago I read some things, but I don't remember what he says about the relationship of Brahman to Narayan. I don't remember. Anyway, he does insist that Narayan does have qualities. There's Vishesha. He's Vishishta. Brahman is Vishishta. There is no Brahman without qualities. That's how Ramanuja would say it. There is no such thing as Brahman without qualities. So Brahman is just, like Jiva Goswami says, I'm not sure he says this, but I presume since he insists that Brahman does have qualities, there's no Nirguna Brahman. So the Nirguna conception is just an incomplete conception of not seeing the qualities. But I'm not sure that he says that. He does say that the Brahman has qualities, and that's it. You know, there is no Brahman without qualities. Yes?
Seems to be putting Krishna's qualities and Supreme Lord's qualities as a divine entity. But we understand that Krishna, his name, his form, his qualities are the same. So what does it mean that different?
How is Ramana just saying that the qualities are living entities?
No, that's something which is different from Supreme.
No, he's not postulating a real complete difference. The qualities of a thing are its prakaras, they're its aspects. So it's not difference, because the Upanishads tell us there's no difference in Brahman. There's no Beda. There's, you know, Brahman is one without a second. And that's not just Mayavadi's talking, that's the Upanishads talking. But Ramanuja's understanding of that is that Brahman has his varieties, his visheshas, or prakaras, his aspects. They're not separate from him. His personal aspects. You can argue about the separated energies, but his personal qualities are part of him. But they're parts. There is a distinction. There's not a separateness, but there's a distinction of the quality and the possessor of the quality. Okay? Not a separate entity, but different part, different aspects of the same entity. Yes. That's more or less how the Ramanuja sees it. Yes?
Can we, like, when we say the Brahman have qualities, and Ramanuja is accepting this, and we are also accepting, what is the difference? Like, Madhvacharya also accepts that. So how they differ from each other?
Madhvacharya more emphasizes the difference. He insists that these five are separate entities. Madhva puts more emphasis on the difference. Ramanuja's blend of difference and sameness is very similar to ours. You know, if there's difference between us and Ramanuja, it's not so much on metaphysics, but on the practicalities of what does liberation consist of. The Ramanuja Sampradaya don't recognize fixed rasas, that we have one sarupa. They say that would be a limitation on your liberation if you can only have one relationship with Krishna. And they say that the liberated living entity is omniscient, he knows everything, which we don't agree with. Liberated living entity knows everything, absolutely. So those are subtle differences about what happens to the jiva when he becomes liberated. But about the basic relationship between God and his energies, there's no real difference between our philosophical stand and the Sri Sampradaya. There is some kind of difference between what we, our metaphysics and Madhva's. There is some difference. We're actually closer to Ramanuja philosophically.
What about
I don't know so much about them. I haven't studied their philosophies. These labels that are put on them, Dvaita, Advaita, Vishishta, Dvaita, Beda, Beda, these are simplistic labels that weren't used by the original Acharyas. So it's a little more subtle than that, a little more complicated. Okay. Did I finish this? Yeah. Okay, we're going to move on to the next paragraph. I'm sorry, you had did we answer your question?
Yeah.
No. We're finished, okay, yeah. All right, we'll move on. Harshakaritam sambramam ahadvabhyam. The flurry of eager reverence caused by their joy is described in the two verses beginning Teva. We're shifting back to the four Kumaras, so maybe we should say that. Let me just put in brackets there, the Kumaras. Otherwise, we were talking about Ramanuja and the city in the sky, and so maybe we lost track of what we're talking about. I'm just adding a word here. The flurry of eager reverence caused by there, the Kumaras' joy, is described in the two verses beginning Teva. Okay, let's go ahead and find those two verses. What's the verse number?
44.
Okay. 44 and 45. Teva amushya varana sita padma kosham udvikshya sundaratara darakundahasam labdashisha punaraveksha tadiyamam vi dvandvam nakaru namadi shoyanam nidadyuhu. The Lord's beautiful face appeared to them like the inside of a blue lotus. And the Lord's smile appeared to be a blossoming jasmine flower. After seeing the face of the Lord, the sages were fully satisfied. And when they wanted to see him further, they looked upon the nails of his lotus feet, which resembled rubies. Thus they viewed the Lord's transcendental body again and again. And so they finally achieved meditation on the Lord's personal feature. 45. Pum sangatim mrigayatam iha yoga margair janaspadam bahumatam nayanabhiramam palms namvapur dashayanam ananya siddhair outpattikai samagrinam yutam ashtabokaihi. This is the form of the Lord which is meditated upon by the followers of the yoga process, and it is pleasing to the yogis in meditation. It is not imaginary, but factual as proved by great yogis. The Lord is full of eight kinds of achievement, but for others, these achievements are not possible in full perfection. We understand the. Grammar teacher might object that you don't say the and doesn't mean all of them. We really mean some of the yogis, not all the yogis. But anyway, it's Prabhupada's translation. And we're not, I guess in the commentary we'll quote the verse. No, we don't. Well, because the verse was discussed, was given earlier at the beginning of the energy. Anyway, the flurry of eager reverence caused by the Kumara's joy is described in the two verses beginning Teva. Actually, Tevai. I have to say Tevai, not Teva, because it doesn't begin Teva. Teva is just a Sunday change. Tevai. Tevai kila vatanam eva asita padma kosha isha. Vikasitam nilambujam tam urd urdvam viksha, splitting up the urdviksha, explaining urd part means urdva, up. They indeed looked up at the dark colored lotus whorl, the slightly blooming blue lotus flower, which was his face. That's a metaphor. They didn't look at a lotus flower, they looked at his face. But metaphorically, it's saying that that was a blue lotus flower. Labda manorata santa naka evaruna manayas tesham shrayanam ashraya bhutam angri dvandvam punaraveksya atotvishtya viksya punar punaha. Having done this, they felt their ambitions fulfilled. Then glancing down, so the udviksha look up, and then avaiksha. See, two different roots mean look, but one of them, udviksha, means look up, and ava means down, avatara. Aviksha means looking down. So they glancing down, they observed his 2 feet, which served as the shelter of the dawn-colored jewels that were his toenails. We said they're rubies. So a ruby red dawn. Uh, aveksha, aho drishya viksha punar punar evam viksha, yugapad sarvanga lavanya grahana shakti, pascha nidadyus tintayamasu. In this way, by looking again and again, they gradually meditated on him, contemplated him. Since it was impossible to perceive the beauty of all of his limbs simultaneously. Okay. No, but that's not what it says. I mistranslated this. It says that because it was impossible to perceive all the beauty of his limbs simultaneously, paschat, later on, they thought about what they saw. In other words, they saw each of the pieces one after another, and then after that, they sat down and put all the pieces together in their meditation. And I didn't really say that in the translation. Can I make a note of that? It may take half a minute here. I have to note this. No. They looked. So it was impossible for them to see the beauty of all his limbs all at the same time. So they looked at one thing, then another, and then after that, they meditated on all of it. Mm-hmm. Yes?
Mm-hmm. They create some pictures of Lord, like this part, that they made some pictures in the mind,
They took all the information, pieces of information, and put together a complete picture in their mind.
Does it mean that they closed their eyes in order to go deep?
It doesn't say that they closed their eyes, does it? You can meditate without closing your eyes. You can think about something without closing your eyes.
I just assume that they look at some part of Krishna's body. It's so attractive that they cannot think or receive any good thoughts. But then it looks like...
You can't. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're looking at something from different sides, you can only see one side at a time. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a limitation of the senses and of the mind. You can't bring everything in at once. Especially you can't see the front and the back of something at the same time.
So, I don't know, maybe it's my speculation, but it looks like that they had to somehow distract from this part of Krishna's body they're looking at right now, and then somehow try to meditate the whole body.
They turned their attention to putting it all together. When they're done looking at each of the separate parts. But I don't know if they closed their eyes.
So somehow, because they are very expert, they would do it in some way, just to distract for particular part of Krishna's body, and then concentrate on the whole body and use their mind. Well, was that their body?
Yes. Okay. Well, also something's added here after that. Jiva Goswami also says, Yugapali Vakatam Idam Idam Sarvam Pashimeti Utkantabi Staivava Poshakam Chintakyam Bhavam Avapur Ityartaha. This implies that they achieved the ecstasy, the bhava called anxiety. It's a vyabhichara bhava. Anxiety, utkanta, which nourished the main ecstasy, the staivava, of their constant relationship with the Lord. They were worrying, how can we see all of this at the same time? So it was actually a stimulation of a vyabhichara bhava. Not just an epistemological fact, but they were getting this particular ecstasy of anxiety because they couldn't see everything at once. And that was nourishing their relation, their basic relationship with the Lord. You know, that increased their attraction. that they're going to have to develop this relationship with him, because they can't just take one look at him and get everything. They have to develop their constant relationship with him. I have a commentary, one paragraph here. A devotee of the Supreme Lord should not try to comprehend in his meditation the whole truth in one piece. He has to perceive the features of the Lord's beauty one after another, and experience the varieties of ecstasies as they confront him beyond his control. Some of these momentary ecstasies, vyabhichara bhavas, superficially resemble painful feelings of material life, but only outsiders ignorant of the actual experience equate one with the other. These vyabhichara bhavas are given the same names as material emotions, like anxiety, but are of a totally different transcendental quality. In pure spiritual life, all experience is favorable, and all apparent pain is actually pleasure. Okay, anyone want to say anything about that? Yes.
Like when we have darshan of the deity, it is advised that we start from the feet and then we go up to the face of the head. But with the Kumaras, they started the other way around. Is that right?
That means that they were developing a more close relationship with the Lord. Out of respect, devotees should look at the feet first. But sometimes, I just turn it off. Sometimes devotees go beyond respect. They lose their sense of respect because of the ecstasy, or because they have a superior relationship. It may be in their relationship. It may be the ecstasy that's making them forget about the respect and look at something other than the feet first. Or it may be that they have a special relationship. Like Kunti Devi. Namo Pankaja Nabhaya looked first at the navel, not the head. She sort of in between. She looked halfway up. Because she's her elder, she's Krishna's aunt, his elder. So she doesn't have a subservient relationship with him. More close, but halfway. So she looks at his navel first. That's the relationship determining it. Or it may just be the ecstasy takes over and you look straight to the face out of ecstasy. Yes?
It looks like in the previous initiative, it was mentioned that Lord Narada, he wanted, it was very eager to show his golden speed, and therefore he went by foot, not on the back of Garuda. So therefore it looks like that he wanted to first attract their attention from the feet, but also through the knees.
But they looked at, I think it says they looked up first and then down. So they smelled what was on the feet. That got them first. But then when they started looking, they looked up and then down. According to the verse, unviksha and then aviksha. Because they're just in ecstasy, they've forgotten all the rules. Yes? Then it may not be their particular relationship with them. They may be in a more formal relationship, but they've momentarily forgotten it. Yes?
But could it be, for example, that it was a second look at Krishna? Like
they did look at the feet first? Maybe. Yeah, maybe.
They saw him first.
Well, we can go back to the first look.
Because his beauty is the driver in the news.
Well, let's see if it says anything about how they were looking. Let's go back to bit 40. Let me do a search for the verses.
38,
you say?
38.
I'm looking at the Sanskrit to make it simpler. Well, it says in 38 they looked at him. Mm-hmm. He was right before their eyes. But it doesn't say what part they were looking at. See, they were already looking, but that description of their first looking doesn't say, at least not in 38, which part they were looking at. They just looked at it. What they saw was fans around him and an umbrella, so that was not him, it's just the paraphernalia. Then Krishna Prasada soon will come, that his face was displaying complete mercy. So the face is mentioned before any other part. Snehavaloka, that's in his face, his affectionate glance. And then they're looking at his chest after that. So it looks like they start from the top down. First the face, then the chest. Okay.
Then, you know, the guards there might have been upset that there, who's this, who are these guys looking at the face first, but they did it anyway.
Yes?
When we say that Angami and Shatakalendra Krishna's body is absurd.
Yes.
At the same time, we also see respect Krishna's, looking at Krishna's feet, we need to have respect. And because we accept the face as higher than the feet in our general behavior. So is it, when we say Angami Shakalendra Vrittimati, how we can understand both? Is it because of our conditioning?
It doesn't say that there's no difference between his feet and his face, that there's not something special in his feet, in his face, that isn't there in his feet. You know, that's why devotees really like to see his face, because his smile is there. You don't see the smile on the feet. Like that. So there is a difference. They're not the same. It's just, what's specifically said is that they can act the same. If he wants to, he can eat with his feet. That doesn't mean there's no difference, but there can be sameness of function.
So our feeling of feet as the face, is, the feet is more respectful and the face is not so respectful. Isn't that culture?
That's a cultural thing, you know, but that's Vedic culture.
Is resembling the spiritual world's culture same here also?
Well, generally it is. In some cultures, you look at someone's feet. But some other cultures, like in Japan, to show great respect, you turn your back to somebody. And don't look at them at all. That's how you know, when somebody's really respectful, you're not supposed to look at them. The emperor or somebody like that. Like when the Americans took over Japan, when they won the war, the Japanese came in the street, you know, to greet them, but they all turned their backs to the Americans. But it was understood that was a sign of respect. So the culture may be different. But generally, you know, show of respect is to look at the feet or to touch the feet, bow down to the feet.
So that culture, what we have here, is the semblance of spiritual culture?
Yeah. I mean, material culture reflects spiritual culture more or less imperfectly. You know, depends on the culture.
The only thing, the misunderstanding should not be there, the feet is and more dirty things like that.
Well, for material people it is.
Yeah.
Like there's Hanumat Prajak Maharaj, when he was still a brahmachari, his job was at the Sunday feast, because there are many old hippies and drug addicts in Berkeley, California. And many of them want to come to the Sunday feast and get prasadam, but he would smell everybody's feet before letting them in. And if their feet were in bad shape, they'd make them take a shower first. So that's material world. Yes?
See, again,
Mahaprabhu
said.
But so the feet is the, you know, the least honorable part. But the Supreme Lord, he's so great all around that even his feet are worshipable. Normally a person's feet are the... You wouldn't touch somebody with your feet, it's an insult.
Yeah.
Because that's the bad part. But for the Supreme Lord, there are no bad parts.
So when we offer something at the feet of the Lord, we don't offer the same ingredient on his face, because it is at his feet.
Offer at his feet.
So is that...
That means we're offering it very respectfully. You know, Mother Yashoda could put it right in his mouth. Because that's intimacy.
What does Krishna's feet can be just on his face? Because we have a distinction of dirty and this is pure.
Oh, but okay, but Krishna's feet are transcendental. No problem. You can put it at his feet. You can touch his feet and be blessed. not going to wash yourself after touching his feet.
I'm saying for Krishna also, is it the same?
For him? How?
Like, if we are giving something to Krishna, he touched his feet. Same thing, can he take also, because his limbs are done?
He may, I don't know if he thinks, maybe he thinks that his feet are dirty, but he has to tolerate devotees touching his feet all the time. He has to tolerate it, even if he doesn't like it. Even if he's thinking, my feet are dirty, they shouldn't be touching, but you know, there's no instruction from Krishna, don't touch my feet. They're dirty, he doesn't say that.
No, I'm asking if for us, because we are mentally conditioned, there is a distinction between his dirty part and pure part.
Yes.
So we don't eat anything, it's just our own feet. So if we say Krishna's body is pure or everything.
Yes.
So when something touches Krishna's feet in the spiritual world, can devotees offer him that point to eat or
you mean after it touches his feet?
Yeah.
You can't offer something twice. If you put it on his feet, that's an offering. And you can't take it and offer prasadam to him again.
Or like a cloth touched his feet and again you're putting it.
Oh, I don't know. I'm not an expert in deity worship. If the cloth touches the deity's feet, whether it's contaminated, I don't know. Probably not. Yeah.
Maybe some just decided to respect Krishna, push.
And we usually offer it near the feet. We don't just dump it on his feet. We put it beside his feet when we make an offering. Yes, sir. Yes? He does that, but to do that, he's a baby. He doesn't do it when he's grown up. I don't see that.
But the offering must still be potentially.
Well, there's no example of grown up Krishna or Narayan sucking his toes. So. Like Narayan doesn't play the flute. He doesn't play it. You know, he has it tucked away somewhere, but he doesn't play it in public. At least in public. So I don't think grown-up Krishna sucks his toes. It's just not. It's just not the mood.
Well, why I'm asking this question is to look like silly, but the reason why I'm asking is when we say that Krishna's body is all pure.
Yes.
But at the same time, and we understand that comparing us that we have distinction because there is a dirt falls in our feet and all, so
yes.
We don't touch it. But Krishna's body is pure. But still there is a, it seems like a respectful attitude in the spiritual world of culture.
But that depends on Krishna's way of looking at it. Does Krishna take offense if something's offered to him after it touches his feet because he thinks it's been contaminated? I don't know.
What the devotees speak also? Because here we have culture and
yeah, but we have to submit to the way Krishna looks at it.
What Mother Yashoda would be doing that is Krishna, she would be feeling
like, I don't know. It's a good question, but I don't know the answer. Maybe the acharyas on deity worship tell us about that. I don't know. I'm not an expert on it. Yes?
I don't know.
Also,
the information. More personal for Krishna to take gold and to put it in his leg.
Then to lay it at his feet?
Yeah. Then.
Yeah, because it's like, you know, dump it at his feet, you put it on yourself. Yeah, it's not so respectful to do that. You make an offering, you actually offer it. You know, here's a sandalwood, put it on yourself. No, you put it on his forehead.
For example, you have some foods and they doesn't mean that you can put the apples and fishes on his feet.
No, but we do leave the plate by him. We don't take a spoon and put it in his mouth. That's not the standard procedure. Because that's the way you feed somebody. You know, unless he's a baby and can't hold a spoon, you put the plate in front of him and let him eat it the way he wants. You don't, you know, if you have a guest who's not a baby, you don't put the food right in his mouth. That's just not normal. It's annoying. You know, let me just eat. Give me a spoon, give me the plate, give me a spoon, I'll eat. But if you're going to give somebody sandalwood paste or garlic, you usually put it on. It's just normal. So Krishna follows the norm. He wants to, because he wants to. If he wanted to do otherwise, he'd let us know. She does. And she throws them at him? At his feet? No, she should. She doesn't do that.
She doesn't throw them.
Yes. But, you know, if Krishna may want, you know, for some special, just like, you know, what was it? Some ecstatic devotee was offering the banana peels instead of the bananas. But that was the Lord's pleasure. Yeah. So, but that's a special situation. If Krishna wants something unusual, he'll let the devotee know in the heart or some other way. Otherwise, he behaves in a way. He creates the norm. Okay, so we're a little late. All glories to Srila Prabhupada, Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai. Okay.